for the White House. Speeches of the 2016 U.S. election.
Please give a warm National Press Club welcome to Dr. Ben Carson.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Candy and I are delighted to be here. And I'll just get right into it because I don't have a whole lot of time, and we're going to want to leave a little time to answer some questions. You know, why did I write this book? And America is such a great place, and I am so glad that I was born here. You know, I have traveled to 57 different countries, gotten to know lots of people and a lot of other ways of life. But this remains the place that is the land of dreams. And I know a lot of people like to criticize our nation and demonize it and say it's responsible for a lot of horrible things. And yet I see a lot of people trying to get in here and not a lot of people trying to get out. So I'm not sure that that really is all that legitimate, to be honest with you. But, you know, growing up, in poverty with a lot of disadvantages, the thing that was really great is I was still able to focus on my dream of becoming a doctor. It was the only thing I ever wanted to do. I skipped right by policemen and firemen and went straight to doctor. And, I loved anything that had to do with medicine. I even liked going to the doctor's office. And I would gladly sacrifice a shot just to be able to smell those alcohol swabs, you know. It was so cool. And, on through the whole process, were there a lot of hurdles along the way? Absolutely. Tremendous hurdles along the way. But nevertheless, it was still possible to realize that dream. And I want to make sure that that continues to be the case. And one of the reasons that it was possible is because we have a system that did everything possible to create fairness, even when there were people in the system who did not want to be fair. And that's why it is so important that we must preserve our Constitution. Virtually all Americans know that we have a Constitution, but how many people actually know what's in it? And how many people actually know what's behind it? And of course, it is the mechanism that guarantees our liberties and that provides the guidelines for the restraint of government. Because our founders recognized that it was the natural tendency of government to grow and to invade every aspect of your life and to try to control your life. That's what people do. And that's what they wanted to avoid by doing this. And that's why it's so important that we understand it. You know, in 1831, when Alexis de Tocqueville came to America to study our great country, because the Europeans were just so flabbergasted that this fledgling nation, barely 50 years old, was already competing with them on virtually every level. And he was going to really dissect it and see what was going on. But one of the things that really impressed him was how educated the people were. You know, anybody finishing the second grade was completely literate. He could find a mountain man on the outskirts of society, and the guy could read the newspaper and could tell them how our government worked. And nowadays, we don't seem to emphasize, you know, civics and things like that in school anymore. And I'm sure some of you have seen some of those man on the street interview situations where they go out and ask just really basic questions and people have no clue what you're talking about. And, you know, they think, you know, you say, well, who's the first president? They say, Reagan? I mean, they have no idea. And it's funny, but it's so sad because, you know, our founders, and particularly Franklin and Jefferson, emphasized education and they emphasized being informed. And they said, our system of government and our freedoms are dependent on a well-informed and educated populace, because they recognized people were not well-informed, that they would be easy to manipulate. And all it would take was dishonest politicians and a complicit news media, and off you would go into another direction very, very quickly. Now, I'll tell you right off the bat before I go any further, I'm not politically correct. I will not be politically correct. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of the people in the press don't like me. But it's okay, because, you know, what I really love is this country. I don't necessarily care whether the press likes me or not. And therefore, I'm not going to conform to all their little requirements. Like, people ask me all the time, well, why don't you just do this and do this? And then they won't say bad things about you. Because this is America. That's why I'm not going to do that. And I never will do that. But I want to touch on some of the aspects of America that I touched on in the book. Like the balance of powers, the check and balance system, the separation of powers. I believe this is so vitally important, and it was a touch of genius by our founders, because they recognized that each branch, executive, judicial, and legislative, would want to maintain their power, and therefore they would push back against excesses in the other branches. And that works extraordinarily well in a government like we have, when they all are exercising their power appropriately. Unfortunately, we have a legislative branch that really acts more like a peanut gallery. You know, they sort of sit there and watch what the others do, sometimes complain about it, but really don't offer any resistance because they're afraid somebody might blame them. Newsflash, they're going to get blamed anyway. So what they really ought to be thinking about is how do they get involved and be more proactive. You know, case in point, you know, I think about, you know, the recent decision by the Supreme Court on gay marriage. Now, first of all, let me just say, I have nothing against gay people whatsoever. Now, I know a lot of people don't believe that, because we live in a society now where if you don't accept their entire agenda, then you're a homophobe. But, you know, I personally believe that any two people, regardless of sexual orientation or anything else, have the right to associate together. If they want to have a legal contract drawn up, which allows them to have hospital visitation rights, do whatever they want. Absolutely. I don't have any problem with that. That's the kind of country that this was designed to be. Live and let live. Not impose your values on everybody else. And that's the problem. But with the Supreme Court ruling that changes essentially the definition of marriage, it doesn't take into consideration the implications of that. If you change it for one group, why won't you change it for the next? What defense do you have against the next group? You're going to say, we can only change it this one time. We're never going to change it again. Well, that wouldn't be very fair. So why change it in the first place? It's been working very well for thousands of years. And that's what happens when people go in and start tinkering with things without thinking about the implications of it. And the legislative branch, however, I would have thought would have been already prepared with legislation in case the Supreme Court came down with that decision to make sure we preserve the rights, the religious rights of everybody. Not everybody agrees with their new definition of marriage, and it's a conviction, and a religious conviction. And they need to make sure that they protect people's religious rights. They've been Johnny-come lately, but I call upon Congress to do that now. Because there are people who are losing their jobs, their livelihood, and that's not fair. It's not what America was supposed to be. But unless all the branches of government are functioning the right way, these are the kinds of things that happen. Because there will be overreach by any of the branches, because they're composed of people, and people are not perfect. But that's why we have the counterbalance, in order to be able to rectify the situation, because one group may not take into consideration the ramifications of what they are doing. Also, you know, the Constitution indicates that, you know, civil issues really should be dealt with at the local level, at the state level. There was a reason for that. It was because the legislators and the judiciary at the local level are subject to the will of the people. The people vote them in, the people vote them out, and our founders felt that the people should be the ones who determined how things worked and the standards by which they lived. When you take those issues and you bump them up to a level where the people making the decisions have no obligation whatsoever to the people, then you wind up with an oligarchy type government. That was not what the founders intended for America. So we are somehow going to have to look into ways to rebalance that, because if we continue down that pathway, you can see how virtually everything that they intended will be upset. We don't want that to happen. The preamble to the Constitution talks about the role of the government in terms of promoting the general welfare. Now, that doesn't mean that we want to put everybody on welfare. That's not what the general welfare is. It means that when we do things, we want to do them in a way that they benefit the entire society. And it is very important, you know, that we take care, that we make sure that everybody is taken care of in an appropriate way. But when I say we, that does not necessarily mean the federal government. You know, I get criticized sometimes, inappropriately, by the way, by people who say, Carson grew up very poor. He must have benefited from some government programs, and now he wants to withdraw all the safety nets. Well, this is nothing but a blatant lie. By people who need to characterize me as heartless. They love to do that. They love to say Carson's insensitive and he's heartless and he hates people, because they need that narrative. That's the only way that it can be acceptable, because I don't fit into their general description. You know, a black person who is a conservative? They can't quite deal with that. Who talks about self-reliance and that you're not dependent on them? Oh, how could you possibly say such heresy? So, you know, it's necessary to demonize individuals like that. And I understand that. And I'm actually willing to fight with them. I will continue to fight with them. But I'm fighting for something even greater. And that is, I'm fighting for the people of the United States. Because, you see, we have very, very smart and very, very capable people in our nation who would be extremely good leaders. But they say, why would I get into that cesspool and be attacked and have my family attacked and have people going through every aspect of my life and trying to demonize me? And people don't want to do that. Well, I'm going to fight that fight for them. And if I'm successful, I expect that maybe a lot more of the people in our country who are not professional politicians will say, you know what? He did it. I'm going to do it too. And I think we'll be much better off as a country when we once again understand that this country is for everybody and not for a specific political class. But but as far as the whole safety net argument is concerned, you know, my mother worked extraordinarily hard, three jobs at a time, leaving the house before 5 in the morning, getting back after midnight, because she didn't want to be dependent. And she occasionally accepted some aid, but for the most part was able to stay off of it. And she refused to be a victim. And she refused to let us be victims. And it wasn't that she didn't recognize that there were problems out there. But she chose to focus on other things. And she would say to us, you know, if you walk into an auditorium full of bigoted, racist people, she said, you don't have a problem. They have a problem. She says, because when you walk in there, they're all going to cringe and wonder if you're going to sit next to them. Whereas you can sit anywhere you want. And, you know, that's that's kind of the way that I have chosen to lead my life. Have there been obstacles? Of course. Have there been racist people around? Of course there have. But I say, that's their problem. I've got some very important things that I need to do. So I can get wrapped up in their problem, or I can do the important things. Not everybody chooses to lead their life that way, and that's fine. But that's the way that I chose to lead mine. And it works pretty well, if I do say so myself. Having said that, I am very concerned about the downtrodden people in our society. And I do believe we have a responsibility to take care of them. But when I say we, I'm talking about we the people. I'm talking about the private sector. I'm not talking about the government. You know, the government, you know, has been taking this on really since Woodrow Wilson, but it kept increasing. By the time we got to Lyndon Johnson and the war on poverty, you know, it was, hey, we're the savior. We're going to take care of you guys. We're going to solve all these problems. Well, here we are all these years later, $19 trillion later, did we solve the problem? We have 10 times more people on food stamps, more people in poverty, welfare, broken homes, out of wedlock births, crime, incarceration. Everything that was supposed to be better is not only worse, it's much worse. So I'm not going to sit here and demonize the government for doing that, but I'm saying, isn't it time to wake up and start thinking about another way to do things rather than driving ourselves into debt without solving the problem? And that is a tremendous responsibility of the government as well, to remain solvent, because you are the guardian of the people's future. I mean, how can we enjoy, you know, the liberties and have our posterity enjoy the liberties if they are overloaded with debt? $18.5 trillion, the national debt. Think about that. To pay that back at $10 million a day, it would take you over 5,000 years. That's absurd. And we're putting that on the backs of our young people. And now, here we are, sitting here saying, let's increase the debt some more. Let's raise the debt ceiling some more. You know, did it ever maybe occur to us that there's another way? I mean, there are 4.1 million federal employees. I would offer that that's too many. And there are 645 federal agencies and sub-agencies, all of whom have budgets. This is absurd. And we have people saying, if you cut the budget by one penny, it will be a disaster. Nancy Pelosi. You know, I mean, this is absolutely absurd, okay? But we must think about the children. And that really is the main reason that I've gotten into the fray here. As a pediatric neurosurgeon, my whole professional career centered on the children and on the future for the children. What we had to do to improve quality of life for them. How can we in good conscience continue this charade of responsibility, knowing what we are doing to their future? If I had time, I would really get into, you know, the fiscal gap and all the implications of that, and what the implications of the debt is on the Fed, and how they're irresponsibly printing money, and how the low interest rates are hurting the poor and the middle class, because, you know, putting money into a savings account or buying bonds doesn't help them. The only people who can really make money are people who can have a risk tolerance, which allows them to go into the stock market. And I would talk about the regulations and how every single regulation costs money in terms of goods and services, and how those are the things that are really impacting the middle class and the poor people. It doesn't matter for wealthy people if a bar of soap goes up 10 cents, but it matters a lot for the middle class and for poor people. You think about that regulatory burden and who it is really hurting. You know, it goes on and on and on. When we're promoting the general welfare, those are the kinds of things we have to be thinking about. And we have to be thinking about mechanisms for allowing the downtrodden in our society to escape from dependency and move up into the fabric of success in our country. And we have to understand that we only have 330 million people. Sounds like a lot. But China has over a billion. India has over a billion. We need to get the bang for the buck out of all of our people. We need to be thinking about policies that allow all of our people to rise and stop all this silly class warfare stuff. You know, and we can get immediate stimulus by thinking about the over $2 trillion that exists overseas right now. We need to bring that money back. You know, I can remember many an afternoon sitting around the board table at Kellogg or Costco, talking about the money overseas and what we were going to do with and how we would love to bring it back in order to build another factory or do something else, but the corporate tax rates were too high. Well, what if we had a six-month hiatus on those corporate taxes overseas, let that money be repatriated? I've been talking about this for several months. And it wouldn't cost them anything to repatriate it. We would only require that 10% of it be used in enterprise zones that are set up in our major cities, or to provide employment for people who are unemployed or on welfare. You want to talk about an incredible stimulus that didn't cost the taxpayers one penny? That would be the biggest stimulus probably since FDR's New Deal. That's low-hanging fruit. That's low-hanging fruit. And, you know, that's what we've got to do, deal with this low-hanging fruit. The other thing is it gets business and industry once again thinking about how do we invest in the people around us. This is what we used to do before the government started taking over everything, because Americans are very generous people. You think about the early America, and you had these communities all over the place, in many cases separated by hundreds of miles. How did they survive and how did they thrive? Because at harvest time, if a farmer was up in the apple tree picking apples and fell out and broke his leg, everybody else pitched in and harvested his crops. If somebody got killed, everybody else pitched in and took care of their family. That's who we are. When there's a disaster in the world, who's always on the front line? It's us. So let's utilize that and recognize that we are our brother's keeper, and it is our duty to take care of the indigent, and is not the duty of the government. And if we learn that, and then You know, another important aspect of our government is to provide for the common defense. Now, I could talk about this for a long time, but simply to allow our military to deteriorate the way it has, to fail to take care of our veterans to the point where we have 22 to 23 suicides every day, it makes absolutely no sense. To leave our electric grid unprotected, it needs to be hardened. We need to have several layers of alternative energy. You know, this is criminal what we're doing, because we are so vulnerable. And, you know, we need to really beef up our cyber capabilities. And I'll tell you, under a Carson administration, if another country attacks us with a cyber attack, they're going to get hit so hard, it's going to take them a long time to recover. We can't sit around and let people do stuff and just say, you're bad, I don't like you. You know, we can't do that. And, you know, we have to understand. We also need to reinvigorate our space program. I think it is a crime that we have moved away from that. Think about all the inventions, the innovation that came out of that. Your cell phone, so many things. And the important thing is, in the future, he who controls space controls the earth. We cannot be tardy to that when there are others who are working very hard in order to conquer that area. And then the last area I just wanted to mention briefly, and I could really go on for quite a while on this one, but there is only one business in America that is protected by the Constitution, and that is the press. And there was a reason for that. It was because the press was supposed to be an ally of the people. And they were supposed to expose and inform the people in a nonpartisan way. When they become partisan, which they are, they distort the system as it was supposed to work. And they allow the side that they pick to get away with all kinds of things. And I think there's still hope for the press. I think it is possible that some of them will recognize that it's almost a sacred obligation that they have to the people to be honest. Well, now, you know, just in the last week, you know, my own case, you know, they take something that I say about the shootings in Oregon and don't put the part in where I was answering the question. Don't put the question in. Just give the response and say, see, he's being critical of the people. I mean, the good thing is that a lot of the people in America are on to them and understand what they're trying to do. And that's one of the reasons we're doing well. And it seems like the more they attack me, the better we do. Because people expect that, you know. And, you know, last week, you know, I'm leaving a press conference, getting ready to get on a bus, and the reporter says, can you tell me what you're going to do about the hurricanes? I said, goodbye. I don't know. You know, the next day, Carson wants to be president, has no idea what to do about hurricanes, you know. I mean, this is the level of insincerity that we see, you know, and it really is kind of embarrassing to see that. And it happens on the other side, too. Now, it's just not just on one side, you know. I was doing an interview with Wolf Blitzer yesterday, and he was asking about, you know, renewal of the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, of course I want, you know, renewal of the Voting Rights Act, or at least the aspect of it that protects all Americans' rights to vote. But, you know, it's a much longer conversation about what needs to be done to it before it is renewed. You know, it was you know, something based on conditions 50 or 60 years ago. A lot of things have changed since that time. We certainly don't want to empower the Department of Justice to do some of the things that the Holder Justice Department did based on that bill. So, you know, everything needs to be looked at in its context. And when news media pick one word or one phrase and they run with it and they try to characterize people like that, I got to tell you guys, that's why people don't trust you anymore. I mean, you're down there with used car salesmen. And, you know, So what is it going to take to save our country? Courage. And it's going to take courage by all of us, including the press. And we have to begin to think about those who come behind us. Because what would have happened to us if those who preceded us were little chicken livers? What if they weren't willing to take risk? What if on D-Day, our soldiers invading the beaches of Normandy had seen their colleagues being cut down, 100 bodies laying in the sand, 1,000 bodies laying in the sand? What if they had been frightened and turned back? Well, I guarantee you they were frightened. But they didn't turn back. They stepped over the bodies of their colleagues, knowing in many cases that they would never see their homeland or their loved ones again. And they stormed those Axis troops, and they took that beach, and they died. Why did they do that? They didn't do it for themselves. They did it for you, and they did it for me. And now it's our turn. And what are we willing to do for our children and for our grandchildren? Are we willing to stand up? Or are we afraid that somebody's going to call us a nasty name? Or that we're going to get an IRS audit? Or that somebody's going to mess with our job? You know, we have a lot less to lose than they did. And the people who are always telling me, hang in there, don't let them get to you, believe me, do not worry about it, because the stakes are much too high. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Carson. I have many questions, including many questions about foreign policy. We have President Putin intervening in Syria, supporting the Assad regime. And this morning we learned that the President of the United States is ending the program for training the anti-Assad rebels. How would you, as President, approach the Syrian situation? What actions would you take?
Well, I think it's a very serious situation, and I think we cannot simply be passive in a situation like this. You know, when the Russian generals tell us, you know, we don't want you guys flying in this area, my response to him would be, go take a flying leap. We'll fly anywhere we want to. But I think we ought to be establishing our own no-fly zone in conjunction with Turkey. And I think we need to recognize that, why is he really there? You know, he said he was coming there to fight ISIS. Has he really been fighting ISIS or al-Nusra and al-Jilani and everybody who, in fact, is opposing Assad? I think that's the real thing. And you'll look and see that Assad is also getting a lot of help from Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran. What's going on there? Because, you know, these relationships are complex. Some people were a little surprised when I indicated that Putin and Ali actually have a long-term relationship, as does Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas and Khomeini were in the same class in Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow, graduating class of 68. And they were already quite familiar with a young Vladimir Putin at that time. And I believe that Putin is very desperate right now because oil prices are very low. That's what's really been precluding his expansionist activities. And not us, believe me. It's the economic situation. Now, he can get a foothold in Syria and then begin to spread his influence throughout that region. And if he can gain control of significant energy reserves, he might then be able to have a much more control on energy prices throughout the world. And that will then embolden him because he will be strengthened to do what he needs to do. But we need to fight him everywhere. You know, we need to be reestablishing the missile defense system, I think, in Eastern Europe. We need to be supplying arms to the Ukraine. We said we were going to protect them if they gave up their nuclear weapons. They gave them up. Did we protect them? Of course not. You know, we turned our back on Israel. You know, I don't think the rest of the world is idly sitting by and noticing that we renege on our responsibilities. So we need to oppose him at every step. We also need to take advantage of his economic weakness by using our economic strength in very wise ways.
The House is looking for a new speaker, and there's a report that Mitt Romney called Paul Ryan and urged him to run for speaker. Is Paul Ryan the guy? Should he run for speaker? And as president, how would you work with Congress to end the gridlock that's defined Washington so often?
Paul Ryan is a fine person. I like him. I like a lot of people in Congress. I hope the process plays out. I hope that a number of people will present their philosophy for leadership and that there is an opportunity for the members of Congress to see who they want to work with as their leader. And what I would do is I would have a policy of talking. You know, the current administration doesn't talk a lot to the people in Congress, not even to their own party. How can you come to resolutions without talking? I mean, what happens before people get divorced? They stop talking. The next thing you know, their spouse is the devil incarnate. You know, that's what we're seeing. And, you know, we all basically want the United States to succeed. We have different philosophies about how that's going to be done. But I think if we're willing to sit down and talk about it, then we find that we're not nearly as far apart as we think we are. We do have to keep the instigators out and the people who try to irritate and agitate. You know, a good example of that is, you know, a few weeks ago when I was on Meet the Press, and I said, I think anybody from any religion or any background who is willing to embrace our values and is willing to put our Constitution above their belief system is acceptable to me. I don't know why that is a difficult subject for people to understand. But anyone whose belief system does not conform to our Constitution and who is not willing to put that under our Constitution, why would that person be the leader of this country? That doesn't make any sense.
In your first 3 months in office, what would be different and how will the people know it?
Well, first of all, I would call for a joint session of Congress. And I would want them to know that under a Carson administration, we recognize that the people are at the pinnacle and that we work for them and they don't work for us. And we have to begin to also understand that We are Americans first, and Democrats and Republicans second, or maybe even third. You know, we have to stop fighting each other, because one of the things that I think threatens to destroy our nation is the extreme divisiveness. And we've gotten to the point where we believe that if somebody disagrees with you, then you need to try to destroy them, destroy their family and their livelihood. Where did that come from? I guarantee you it did not come from our Judeo-Christian values and roots.
As president, who would you want as chairman of the Federal Reserve, and or what kind of qualities do you want in that person?
Honesty and common sense would be good starters. And that's not to say that we haven't had such people. You know, I like Janet Yellen. You know, I've served on a board with her. She's a very decent person. I think she's trying very hard. But you got to realize that we've put the Fed in a very difficult position right now because of the amount of debt that we've accumulated. It's very hard for the Fed to allow interest rates to rise to a reasonable level with an $18+ trillion national debt. The debt service on it with an interest rate suppressed almost to zero is still $250 billion a year. Can you imagine what it would be if we allowed the interest rates to rise to their normal levels? So we need to be working on driving that debt down, and I have some ideals about how that can be done. And that can have a very ameliorating effect and some freedom for the Fed. But the other thing is I would like to see somebody who understands that we can't just print money based on the good name and faith and credit of the United States of America. You know, we decoupled, you know, in 1973 and 1971 from the gold standard. It doesn't have to be gold. There are other things that it can be coupled to, but we need to have some responsible underlying to what we do, and I think it will make a big difference.
You mentioned your comments on Meet the Press, and I've gotten several questions from the audience about related to that. One questioner says, Muslims serving in the U.S., there are Muslims serving in our United States military, our police forces, in our courts, our school boards, our city councils, so on and so forth. So how is it okay for a Muslim to serve and die in the military to defend our values, or for a judge to uphold the Constitution, even though the faith of those individuals are incompatible with the Constitution they are sworn to protect and uphold? Long question, but you get what they're getting at.
Well, again, a good understanding of the Constitution answers that question for you, because when you look at the Article 2, and we're talking about requirements for the president, and they have to be a natural-born citizen. Now, why is that the case? I'm sure if you had gone to the founders and said, but what about this person? They may not be a natural-born citizen, but, you know, they've been in America for most of their lives, and, you know, they're a fine, upstanding citizen. They've served in the military. They came back. They were on the police force. Can't they be the president? And they would have said, no. They said, we don't even want to take the slight chance that we would put someone in that position who had different loyalties. That's the answer to your question.
A questioner about your opposition to Obamacare, and the question along the lines of, you're a doctor, and obviously all the parts of medical care are important to you, preventative care, many of the things that Obamacare provides. So the questioner is wondering how your values as a doctor and the importance of people getting health care squares with your opposition to this program that has given so many access to health care.
Chomping at the bit for that one. First of all, the reason that I don't like the so-called Affordable Care Act. It's not because it doesn't work and not because it's not affordable. But the real reason is because it flies in the face of the very principles of the establishment of this country. This country was supposed to be of, for, and by the people, with the government there to facilitate life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. With that act, the government comes along and says, I don't care what you people think. This is what we're doing. We're cramming it down your throat, and if you don't like it, too bad. Well, that is antithetical to the whole concept of the people being at the pinnacle and the government there to serve it. It basically flips the relationship and puts the government in the driver's seat with us at its beck and call. And if they can do that with the most important thing you have, your health and your health care, it's not long before they can do it with every aspect of your life. And it begins the fundamental changing of America. And that's why I want to stop it in its tracks, turn it around. I think most people did not recognize what was happening. We have to once again restore the people to the pinnacle. Now, having said that, I do want everybody to have good care. It is consistent with who I am. And, you know, I've talked about a healthcare system, but let me just talk about the part for the indigent. You know, how do we take care of the indigent now? We have Medicaid, $400 to $500 billion a year. How many people participate? About a quarter of the population, which is way too many, by the way. And we can address that by how do we get the economy rolling again. But if 80 million into 400 billion goes 5,000 times, $5,000 every man, woman, and child on Medicaid, that's how much is allocated. What could you buy with that? Most concierge practices cost between $2,000 and $3,000 a year. So you can put them all in a concierge practice and still have a couple $1,000s left over for their catastrophic insurance, which is much cheaper because there's something else that we've done with that that I don't have time to explain. But I'm not saying that we do that, but I'm saying we have enough money to do that. And what's the result of that? Now when Mr. Jones has that diabetic foot ulcer, you know, he's not going to go to the emergency room where it costs five times more. He's going to go to the clinic where he gets the same treatment. But instead of just patching him up and sending him out, they're going to say, Mr. Jones, let's get your diabetes under control so you're not back here in 3 weeks with another problem. A whole nother level of savings, which is not being recognized right now. And we're teaching him personal responsibility rather than dependency. Those are the kinds of things that we should be doing. That will cost us a lot less money, and everybody will be of equal value. You won't have people that people say, I don't want to see them. You know, they're going to have to go to the emergency room. And it's going to cost us actually less money. That's the kind of thing we should be doing, and that's the kind of thing we can be doing when we take something so important as medicine out of the political arena and start taking care of our people.
I've received several questions from the audience about guns and your comments about the Holocaust and if Jews had been able to protect themselves, much of it could have been prevented. I'll let you clarify that. And also the whole approach to these mass shootings, is having more people armed the kind of thing that can stop more of these mass shootings, do you think?
Okay. Well, you know, the Holocaust issue, that's just the left-wing press again trying to stir up a controversy, in which I expect of them. That's what they do. But, you know, basically what I said is that when tyranny occurs traditionally around the world, they try to disarm the people first. And that's exactly, you know, what happened in Germany, you know, in the, you know, mid to late 30s. You know, they started the program of disarming the people. And by the mid 40s, look at what had happened. And it's happened in a number of other countries as well. Daniel Webster said tyranny would never occur in America because the people are armed. So there's a reason that we have the Second Amendment. And it doesn't mean that I'm not happy to look at ways to keep these tragedies from occurring as long as they don't interfere with the Second Amendment. That's what we have to keep in mind. And then what was the other part of that question?
Will it help prevent more of these?
Oh, by having... Well, with the mass shootings, one of the things that many people have noticed is that they tend to go to places that are gun-free zones. So even though they may be mentally disturbed, they're not so mentally disturbed as not to be able to realize that if you go someplace where people can shoot you, you're probably going to get shot. So what I'm saying is that it's probably a good idea to make sure that there are people in the areas where we have vulnerable people who can oppose these people, not with just words, but who are trained. You know, they can be retired policemen, retired military. Some teachers might have the ability to do that. But I would feel much safer if my kid or grandchild was in a school where I knew that there were people who could protect them if somebody like that came in. To me, what I'm talking about is common sense. To some of the people out there, there is no such thing as common sense.
We are almost out of time. Before I ask the final questions, I have some housekeeping. The National Press Club is the world's leading professional organization for journalists, and we fight for a free press worldwide. To learn more about the club, visit our website, that's press.org, and to donate to our nonprofit Journalism Institute, visit press.org/institute. I also want to remind you about some upcoming events. On Thursday, October 15th, the club will hold its annual Fourth Estate Award Gala. This year, we will honor Gwen Eiffel, moderator and managing editor of Washington Week and co-anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour. On Wednesday, October 21st, we will reprise a press club event from 100 years ago when Senator Tim Kaine and other members of Congress face off against members of the news media in the Politicians versus the Press spelling bee. And on Friday, October 23rd, Oscar-winning director and actor Kevin Costner will be here to discuss his new book. I would now like to present our speaker with the honorary National Press Club mug. You have been here before, so you're developing a collection. So a couple of final questions. If the situation was right, down the campaign trail, circumstances change. Would you consider being Donald Trump's running mate?
The press will have a field day with this one. And by the way, before I answer that question, I just want to mention many in the press will say that I'm sensitive. And, you know, that I should not be thinking about running for office because I get offended by what they do. Of course they'll say that. But the reason that I expose the press is because I want the people of America to understand what they're doing. So it's not because I'm sensitive. I will continue to expose them every time they do something. So because as more people understand who they are and what they're doing, it will negate their effect. And that's until they have the kind of transformation that is necessary for them to become allies of the people, we have to know what they're doing. Now, in terms of Trump, how could I forget? Okay. You know, I believe that that Donald Trump has been very useful because he's brought in a lot of people, brought in a lot of curiosity and enthusiasm. And whoever the eventual nominee is will benefit from that, even if it's him. That's a good thing. So, you know, that's one of the reasons I don't talk about him. I don't talk about anybody else. But in terms of a vice president, I would obviously want somebody who is compatible with me. I would not necessarily be looking for somebody who can bring in this demographic or that demographic, because the things that have to be done are very, very serious things, quite frankly. This can't be tampering around the edges. We've got to go to the heart of the matter, and I don't think we have a whole lot of time to do that. So it would have to be somebody who is very compatible, who understands the urgency of what we are doing, who is willing to suffer the slings and arrows to get it done. That's what it will take.
Ladies and gentlemen, please give a round of applause to our speaker.